While it never explicitly stated what Abhel is, they did mention that it was a fate worse than death and would involve breaking down a person to the point where they would wish for death no matter how painful. It is neither an afterlife nor a mythos, but rather a living hell.
High School of the Dead from the anime High School of the Dead by Kishida Kyodan and the Akeboshi Rockets. This is episode 45 of Anime Addicts Anonymous podcast, and I am one of your lovely hosts, Kimiko, along with
Mitsugi. Man, it's amazing how like natural we do the openings now. That was perfect.
Thanks.
No retries at all. No bloopers here.
I'm Chiaki, and I love you all.
And moving on. You can find us at AAApodcast.com, iTunes, Facebook, NerdNexus.com, and ADDNetwork.net.
Dun-dun-dun-dun-dun!
So, some announcements that we have for today is our new forum members. We have Animalia, Adam's Cow, Wheel, and Keyboard Failure.
That's my favorite.
Is your keyboard a failure? Keyboard failure?
I think that name keyboard failure is very clever.
I think so too. Oh, and we also have some belated birthdays. J-Ro, Plixic, Anarchy, and I'm going to pronounce your name so wrong, I apologize. Chanon Ozakaki.
Yeah, a lot of you seem to turn like 20 and 21, so it's a good age. I know from experience.
Wow, you're all still like a lot younger than me, which was the case forever.
Unless you discover time warp.
I hope so.
Oh, God, if one of you discovers time warp, please, please let me know.
I'm warping like 500 years in the future.
I'm going to the past, man, and I want to visit 1930s New York.
I'm going to go to the past with money. Talking Google.
Yeah.
Good plan. But anyway, congratulations are in order for Genevieve. For winning last week's trivia. So congratulations, Genevieve. Yay!
Also, I wanted to say about the trivia. I'm sorry I didn't post the first question on the forums. Sometimes, I don't know, I forget to take my pills in the morning or something like that. And I forget things. But I wanted to say the question, even though it's not on the forums, is always on the main page of the website. And it occurs to me that a lot of you bookmark the forums and just go right to the forums. And I'm not going to say to not do that, but I am going to say that maybe you want to bookmark the front page and then access the forums from the front page. Because, like, if you bookmark the front page of the website, you can always access the forums with just one extra click if you just want to go there. But on our front page, we always have, like, our news and announcements, you know, where we're going to be, things that are coming up,
not to mention our blog.
We have our blog right up there, front and center. We have the trivia question always posted up on the front page. So it's like, if you want to go to the forums, you're just one click away from the front page. But at least if you stop at the front page, you're not going to miss out on any of that. So That's Chiaki's website disclaimer. I try to make it one-stop shopping as much as I can.
I also wanted to say that Canada Man has been doing a marvelous job blogging.
He really has been. All of our bloggers have been great.
So much so.
And speaking of the blog, I just want to say we have a new blogger, Kalilia. So, welcome, Kalilia.
Yes, we look forward to reading your wonderment.
Actually, she's already posted some. And they've
been... I look forward to reading that wonderment. I'm sure it's spectacular.
It is spectacular. She's a very good... I think it's actually a she. I don't think it's a trap. She's done very good work already, and we look forward to more of it. So I cannot stress enough, go check the blog, comment on the blog. I know it's one more thing to check, but hopefully everyone can get in the habit and realize what an awesome thing it is.
Also, indeed.
Guess where we're going later this month?
MetroCon!
MetroCon!
MetroKizzle!
Largest convention in Florida.
Oh, yes.
For anime.
And guess, I'm sorry, I hate to toot my own horn, our own horn.
It needs to be tooted. I'm just saying, it needs to be tooted.
Toot it.
Thank you. Toot. Apparently, thanks to Chiaki, who called me earlier and told me today, Hatake and I are going to be performing in Anime Idol. After all, we're one of the 10 finalists chosen to perform on the day of the con, and yeah. That'll happen.
And it'll be awesome. Yay!
Wish us luck. And hopefully we will return with some form of prize to show for it.
It's not on Friday, or it's not on the last day of the con. It's on Friday at 3.
Indeed. Indeed. So if you're going to be there and you want to stop by and wish two of your lovely hosts some breaking of legs, then please do so, because we would love the extra boost of confidence.
Also,
but it'll be more fun.
We will be at MetroCon, just as another small reminder, obviously, by this whole conversation, but we're going to have a booth in the Artist Alley for anyone who has been living under a rock and has missed all the past episodes. And I am going to be selling stickers and magnets that I've designed and created. Hatake is going to be selling custom artwork, and Kimiko decided what she's going to be making for the masses.
Oh, yes. I am going to be selling commissioned fan fiction. Because I can't draw to save my life, but I can write. I can write. So I am going to be offering various levels of, you know, fan fiction wonderment, and people can commission various characters, OCs, various levels of adult or non-adult, I suppose. And hopefully that'll turn out well. I'm pretty sure nobody's ever done it as an Artist Alley commission option, so let's keep our fingers crossed that people actually want to buy some stuff that is not art.
So definitely come out to MetroCon if you can. We look forward to seeing you, and if you do make it out, stop by our table, and we're doing a lot of panels, so yeah.
Please do.
I have one final announcement before we get things rolling. We are starting a new character battle coming up. The forum members have been submitting their nominations for the brackets, and I'm going to actually make the bracket this week, and for the next 3 weeks, people will be able to make their brackets on bracketmaker.com. And the theme this time, it's a little bit different. It's good versus evil. So on the left side of the bracket, we're going to have all of the most prolific villains from anime history, all the ones we can fit in. So you're going to have 32 of the most famous villains.
Or at least the most famous of our forum members.
Right. Or
go, Isaiah!
I'll fill in the gaps. And on the right side, we're going to have the same thing, but for the heroes. So that way, at the end of the contest, it will be the number one villain versus the number one hero in the epic match of good versus evil that will make the world explode.
Yay!
Episodes before the planet is destroyed.
Exactly. So, pretty soon, visit the website to get the information on how to submit make your bracket on bracketmaker.com. And the prize this time is going to be the 200-plus glossy-page book that was donated to us, Cosplay in America.
It is a great book.
It's so cool. It is so cool.
And the I guess he's still the author slash photographer. Actually, we met him. He's a great guy. He signed the book, so it's a really nice hardcover book, and we're really excited to give this away to some lucky person.
And of course, we'll sign it too, but if you want to learn more about the book, it's at cosplayinamerica.com, so go check that out.
Well, we'll sign it if you want us to sign it.
Right, well,
sure.
Yeah. So, that's about it. So why don't we get started?
Indeed. Our podcast agenda for this evening, our main topic is going to be, where do you see anime in 10 years? So that'll be interesting. Then we're going to take a short anime news break and return with some reviews that were requested by our forum members. Mitsugi will be doing a review on Crest and Banner of the Stars, both of them, requested by Nozaku. And Chiaki will be doing a review on Phoenix 2772 Space Firebird, requested by Coolname. So, yeah, let's get started.
So, where do you guys see anime in 10 years, aside from on your couch?
Well, I know that we're all taking kind of different angles to this.
Oh, yes.
I'm definitely taking more of the business outlook on anime. Chiaki's taking more of the art outlook. And Kimiko, you're taking more of the fan outlook.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'll just keep going, I guess. First of all, I want to say that right now, anime is being outsourced from other countries, not in Japan. A lot of anime is not being made in Japan right now. It's being made in Korea. It's being made in China. And one thing you're going to notice in 10 years is that as the standard of living continues to rise in countries like China, it's no longer going to be affordable to make animation in those countries either. So you're probably going to find animation production being moved to other countries like Vietnam, Malaysia, Thailand, Indonesia. Probably not Africa, because there's not enough skilled labor there.
I'm sorry, but I shouldn't make jokes about Africa. I'm going to hell.
Africa will be...
Yeah, good job, Chiaki.
It's actually called island hopping. The theory that this is one way that nations become developed, and eventually Africa will have their turn.
Oh, I know they will.
But look for some other countries, such as other East Asian countries, to have their turn with animation in the future. I don't know how that's going to impact, like, the styles or whatever, but...
Well, I mean, we already have, like you said, a lot, well, I don't want to say a lot, but a fair number of anime at this point is already being outsourced to these other countries, and I don't think anyone looks at it and goes, oh, God.
Yeah, actually, I'm a big fan of Korean art. I think that the Koreans do a wonderful job animating and also drawing manga.
Oh, yeah, I've read some spectacular manga from Korea.
And not to get too far off topic from the business side, but if anime is continually being outsourced to other countries, is the definition of what anime is over the next 10 years going to drastically change as less and less is being done in Japan? Because I think now, you know, you see it in people who don't know much about anime. They say, oh, that Japanime.
Well,
is perception going to change, or as it's being outsourced more and more, or is it still going to be perceived as a Japan thing, even if it's no longer being made explicitly in Japan?
I think for a while it's looked at as still a Japan thing, you know, until people start to get a more outward reach, a more, you know, understanding that it's coming from other places. Because, I mean, even now, people don't really see the difference, even though there is one. So, I don't know. I've looked at a lot of people, you know, reading when I've read some manga from Korea, and they still just assume that it's from Japan, just because of the style. So,
well,
who knows?
This is kind of a fun episode, because it's all speculation the whole time, but I honestly think that things aren't going to change a whole lot in that regard. Even though the animation will be done in part in other countries, the other aspects of the anime, such as the writing, the directing, the actual production of the anime, probably the music, all of these things are still going to be Japanese.
Right.
That's one of Japan's core competencies, to use a business term. And it's just going to be, in my opinion, the very basic manual labor of creating the art that's going to be going to other countries.
I think another big thing on the business side, and one thing that I wish Hatsuke was here for. By the way, Hatsuke's not with us because she's on a trip, just so everyone knows. She's all right.
It's because it's her birthday.
It is her birthday, so wish her a big happy birthday on the forums, you guys.
Mm-hmm.
Appreciate it. But anyways, I mean, on the business side of things, we've already seen a lot of the, you know, fan subbing and dubbing houses and, you know, all that massive debate, and not to necessarily rehash all that again, but do we think that's going to change in the next 10 years?
I think the problem is going to get worse as the internet continues to become faster and faster, and believe it or not, there are still people in the United States that don't have internet access.
Hmm.
It's probably a very small percentage of people, but as the internet continues to improve in speed, and as more and more people catch on that it's on the internet, I think that the dubbing houses like Funimation are going to have an even harder time in the future.
God, they're already having such a hard time.
That's just speculation, but I honestly think that it's not impossible to see English dubbing completely wiped out in the next decade. That's just that's a very, like, bold statement to make.
But no, it's sad, but it's true. I mean, considering, it's hard to think about considering that Funimation specifically seems to be doing so well. I mean, they've got their hands in pretty much everything that's going on. Even Durarara was just recently optioned, and I'm not going to say by who because I'm going to mess it up and Hatake will, you know, have my ass. But
but
Funimation looks like they might very well have a hand in that as well. And even though it's the completely other organization that's dubbing that, Funimation is still involved. I think it's Aniplex or something. I don't know. But even though it looks like they're doing so well for themselves, I've heard people who are, you know, higher ups, not just as actors, but also as people involved in, like, directing or producing, say that they've been having a hard time with keeping advertisement going and keeping people buying, you know, certain, like, actual DVDs because it's so easy to get on the internet. Like, it's destroying them slowly but surely. So, all things considered, I agree with you wholeheartedly. If this keeps up, it's not going to be around much longer as an option. They just can't afford it.
I mean, I was going to add to that, too, is that it's like, even though Funimation seems like they have a hand in everything, you know, how could they be doing poorly? That's the fact that they have a hand in everything is a good indicator, because if one company is covering a whole market, what happened to the other companies, you know? They all died.
Yeah.
That's a fact.
They all sure.
The state of dubbing in America is already on a downhill trend, and the reason why Funimation is having a hand in everything is their competitors are slowly disappearing.
Well, that's another problem. You know, if you really want to get into the business type stuff, first of all, Funimation has an advantage that a lot of these other companies don't, and that's that they have licenses from video games. They,
mm-hmm.
they make a lot of money off the Dragon Ball Z video games. But if it does come to pass that Funimation ends up being one of the only companies left, what you're going to have is you're going to have a couple things happen. First, there's going to be basically Funimation will be able to do whatever they want with pricing. If there's no competition, then there's no reason for them to price competitively with other companies. And also, probably even more alarming would be the complacency that you would see with the company. If there's no competition, then there's no reason for that company to strive to innovate and to strive to become better. That's one of the things that competition does in the marketplace, is that it forces companies to excel so quickly. And you're probably going to see a company that's all alone stagnate.
I don't want to, like, I can see where you're going with that. Being as involved, I'm going to be the voice of Hatake for a second because I know that she'd jump on you for that one. But even though I can see what you're talking about, Funimation is also the sort of organization that even before they were the major anime dubbing organization that they are now, they were still trying to pick the hardest things to dub or pick the ones, like, Funimation was the one who did Beck. And Beck was the sort of anime that nobody wanted to put their hands on because they knew it was so difficult. They knew trying to do the music on top of the dubbing was just such a huge Mondo challenge and that doing it right was going to be a bitch and a half. But they did it anyway, even knowing it could probably go completely down the tubes because they care about the anime that much and they were such big fans. They're Funimation is an organization of fans, more than anything else. And as much as I can see where you're going with that, I honestly think that even if they were the only ones left, they would still be all about the quality of the work. So hopefully that wouldn't be an issue.
Well, it's not necessarily what they dub that I'm talking about. It's more like, are they going to improve the process of dubbing? Are they going to find a way to make the licenses cheaper? You know, because if they're the only person, then they have no reason to try to make their anime cheaper. And, it's a lot of things. But, you know, these are problems that are going to unfold on their own. I mean, you can make an argument one way or the other, but it's been happening in every single industry since time began. But, and the last thing that I have before I basically pass it off to you guys for a while is I think there's going to be a revolution in anime subject matter. Right now, we're seeing practically every single anime is about schools. I don't think that it's just because the people that are writing the anime can't think of anything else to write. It isn't like they all have writer's block. I think that, honestly, people go out on the streets and they survey the populace and find out what people want to see in anime. And I think what's going to happen, at least I hope, is that people are going to get sick of watching school animes. I know that school animes have been around forever, but it's like, you know, whereas in the 90s, maybe you have like 15, 20% of the animes being school animes. Right now, I feel like it's closer to 60%.
Yeah.
I expect that to peter off and turn into something new, and I don't really know what that is. And I'm not even talking about Moe and all this. Moe is always going to be around. But I'll be very curious to see what kind of trends emerge in the future. I know it's not going to be school.
Almost definitely. I mean, something like that can only last so long before people start wanting some sort of change, even if it's a small change.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we've already seen it happen to an extent. I mean, look at back in the late 80s, kind of 90s era of anime. Like, everything was Magical Girl. I mean, not everything, but let's face it, like, a lot of things were Magical Girl back then.
Yeah.
Like, you could throw a stick into a box of anime, and it was going to land on a Magical Girl something. But, I mean, it's like, and then it shifted to what it is now, and it's going to shift again. But I just hope it's something
good.
Good. I don't know. We'll all think it's awesome for the first year, and then we'll get sick of it. But my side of things, what I'm personally interested in, where anime goes in the future, is with art and technology. Because as more and more technology becomes available, more and more techniques can be achieved, and, you know, things can be experimented with, and so on and so forth, that, like, I mean, I think a great example of this is the anime Genkutsuo. Because whether you like that anime or not, or whether you like the style or not, putting all those aside, that it uses effects that you couldn't have dreamed of achieving 10, 15 years ago. I mean, just been an astounding level of work to achieve things like that back then. But, I mean, they're able to do it now because of computers, and because of the fact that because computers have removed the need for actual, quote-unquote, cells, and they've completely changed the way animation is made. And I think this will keep going, but I think the, quote-unquote, heyday of computers, I don't want to say is gone, but the initial heyday, I think, has passed. And I think now we're going to see things like 3D somehow being integrated into anime. I don't know what else to say. Like, more CG being in anime, which I'm honestly not a fan of myself.
We need to have our episode on 3D. I have so much
to say. We already have,
that.
I thought.
No, it was just me and Valentine arguing about it way back in the day.
Well, either way.
Can I add in on that, the CG? As an example, Hatake and I were watching, Romeo x Juliet, and I don't remember if it was the first episode or one of the first initial scenes, but you've got this really cool, like, brilliantly drawn, absolutely beautiful scenery of, like, castle and stuff like that, and just, you know, very, not medieval, but, you know, just, it looks really pretty. And then you've got these huge CG flags blowing in the breeze. And it just looked like a giant eyesore on the rest of the animated screen. It was completely ridiculous looking. And I know, like, they were going for more realism, but it was just like, I'm going to slap some computer-generated flag right there, and I'm gonna make it blow and look like the wind is taking it away, and it just does not work with the rest of it.
You know,
I don't know.
I'm more of a holistic anime watcher. I like to see my anime done by hand, the way that the good Lord, no, I'm just kidding. the way that anime was originally done.
Oh yeah, I mean, if you're gonna throw some CG in there, make it really subtle. Maybe like the water, like make the water look a little bit more realistic. If it's in, like, you know, the background, if it's an ocean scene, throw a little bit of CG in there if you want. But just don't make like the entire ocean look like one giant computer generated mass when everything around it is like pretty drawn hills or perfectly, you know, 2D animated surroundings and sky and clouds. And there are ways to make it subtle and make it, you know, an added bonus. And that what we're seeing is like a slap in the face, and it's just not beneficial the animation, I don't think, anyway.
I wonder if, rather than seeing computers being pushed out by something even more advanced like 3D, what if there is a regression back to hand-drawn anime?
No.
No.
I'm going to say a firm no for the business reason. Because I think maybe you could see a regression to things like Makoto Shinkai, where it's produced on the computer, but it's not CG.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still done by hand, quote-unquote, but it's done with programs like Photoshop and Painter and things like that. But I don't think you'll go back to, like, true cells, because it's just not advantageous for the company.
I would argue that it's more expensive to pay highly educated people a highly above average wage to work on Photoshop and in advanced softwares than it would be to have like very uneducated poor people in Thailand making cells.
But it's quicker, and time is almost literally money.
Maybe, but you know how many people there are in Indonesia?
That is true, but yeah. I still think it's in many ways cheaper for them to go CG. And I think as the industry is developing, I mean, you say, like, highly educated people who can use the programs, and I know that you're probably comparing them to, like, you know, people in Indonesia who have barely seen a computer or something like that. But, like, in modern, or I don't want to say modern, but in technologically advanced nations, or even moderately technologically advanced nations, people who are going into industries which involve these things know how to use these programs. Like, if I wanted to be a graphic designer and I didn't know how to use Photoshop, no matter what my schooling was, I could not claim to be a graphic designer. And I think the demands on the artists are changing. I think it's no longer about knowing how to paint cells and work with acetate and photograph cells and paint in lines and things like that. But I think the demands of the industry are starting to change from the hard art to the digital.
I can see that. But, I mean, if it was going to stay the same anywhere, it would be in, you know, Asian countries. But, yeah. So, well, can I add one more thing?
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay. Just really quick. I bring that up because a friend of mine once told me her grandfather was this big animator, and she wanted to grow up to be a 2D animator as well, but because of the way animation sort of dwindled really harshly in the U.S., she had to choose graphic design as her major because there was no profit in being a 2D animator. And she's told me more than once that if she wanted to be a 2D animator, she would have to go to Korea or Japan,
yeah,
because that's the only place where it still exists fully as its own art form. Even, you know, trying to bring it back with something like Princess and the Frog in America wasn't completely 2D. So,
but even though it exists, like, even though it physically exists, it's still not the norm.
Valid point.
I mean, even though there is more 2D animation, like traditional 2D animation, and there is, and it's more accepted by the populace. I mean, it's still, look at Miyazaki's newest film. I mean, even Ponyo had elements of CG involved in it. And it was still a lot of cell work, which I liked, because I think that Miyazaki is a genius at that, and I think if he stops doing it, it's going to be an incredible disservice to him. But that aside, there was still a great amount of cell use, but there was also still a great amount of CG in Ponyo. So, I don't think that it's going to become a... I don't think it's ever going to become something which, you know, CG's not going anywhere, is my point. And if anything, I just think it's going to become more and more prevalent over the next 10 years.
I can see it. Something that I wanted to cover was basically the fandom of anime in the U.S. There's two sides of the spectrum, one of which I don't really think is entirely true, but I'm going to throw that out there anyway, whether anime will be in the U.S. at all in a decade, which is obviously most likely.
I hope so.
I mean, I don't see it...
Yes.
It might very well dwindle a little bit. Like, the popularity of anime right now is pretty extreme. Like, it's gotten... In the last 10 years, it's grown a lot in the U.S. I mean... When I think back to when I was 10, I watched Dragon Ball Z, Sailor Moon, Pokemon, and that was it. Those were what were big, and those were kind of like gateway anime. And then in this decade that's passed, you know, specifically in my high school years, which were like 2-ish years ago, I guess it would be like 2 to 4 years ago, it just exploded. On the world, on the U.S. It went crazy, and all of a sudden, animes were popping up that I've never even heard before, and different styles, like manga, had been coming out that I didn't know existed, and it was like, all of a sudden, this entirely new thing that was anime just grew out of nowhere, and I think there's either the possibility of it getting even worse in a decade, and I don't mean worse as in it's bad, I mean, like, worse as in even more brilliantly insane, or it could dwindle, and it could start receding back into an underground thing like it was 10, 15 years ago. What do you think?
I can see that happening, especially if the dubbing houses collapse.
Oh yeah, they hold a lot of the major popularity, I think, or from the popularity of, like, 90% of all con-goers who... are, like, the big benefactors of sale are dub fans.
But I want to say that point I just made, the statement, is kind of contradictory in that the reason that the dubbing houses are failing is because people aren't using them. So, in a sense, you know, it's gonna hurt the overall popularity and the overall prevalence of anime if the house has collapsed, but at the same time, what you might have happen is you might end up seeing some of these big fan subber houses becoming the new studios. Think about that.
I can see that. I can definitely see that. I mean, I do think that a lot of the people who watch dubbed are still watching them online. It's not like you can only find subbed online, but a majority of the people who are finding their anime and watching it online are watching it subbed.
There's really not that big of a difference. I mean, there is a difference between the dubbing houses and these fan subbers, but if you really think about it, fan subbing requires a lot of specialized skills, too. You have to have several people that are fluent in both languages that can translate quickly, and you know they're doing it quickly because these episodes come out like a mere handful of days after they come out in Japan. Then you got to have proofreaders and the typesetters, and you got to have... The process of subtitling anime alone is a nightmare. So, you might find that people start charging for fan subs in the future.
I wouldn't doubt it. I mean, these people have already started creating their own little organizations for these whole fan subbing things, the same way that some people have created their own Scanlations organizations, you know? Like, they've created groups who are specific, you know, fan subbers for anime that are scanned online. so, or manga that's scanned online. So I wouldn't be surprised if they just take it a step further. It wouldn't be difficult.
But, you know, this is a pretty in-depth topic. I think it might actually make a good topic for future episodes.
Cool beans.
Yeah, and obviously we want to hear what you think. It's all speculation. There's no right or wrong answer. So chat us up on the forums. Where do you see anime in 10 years?
Indeed. Well, cool beans then. I suppose we will take a short break for some delicious mouth-watering anime news, and when we return, we'll hit up some reviews.
Hey all you anime addicts out there, this is Chiaki and this is your anime news break. First up, we have a press release sent to us by Anime Festival Orlando. Anime Festival Orlando takes place August 6th, 7th, and 8th at the Wyndham Orlando Resort. It's the 11th year of the con and it's family-friendly entertainment. Some of the voice actors that Anime Festival Orlando is going to have is Sony Strait, Ruben Langdon, Dan Southworth, Jason David Frank, David Yost, Tony Oliver, and Tommy Yoon as guests at the event. Sony Strait is best known for his voice acting on the popular anime series Full Metal Alchemist. For anyone who doesn't know, he voiced Maze. Other fan favorites are work on Lupin the Third, Dragon Ball Z, and One Piece. Other things from the press release include the fact that the Swords of Orlandia trilogy has gotten an add-on. It's a new interactive convention experience called The Skies of Orlandia. It's a story that attendees can voluntarily participate in, and it goes on all weekend long. And let me tell you, I was there last year. The fans go crazy over this. So if it's your first time headed out to Anime Festival Orlando, I really recommend checking it out. It could be a great role-playing gaming experience if you're into that. Ticket prices are $50 for a 3-day adult membership, $30 for Friday or Sunday only, and $35 for Saturday only. In some other news, for fans of J-Rock out there, Der En Grey, the popular J-Rock band, has set a tour in North America. 15 cities were announced for the tour starting on August 23rd, which will last into September 11th. Cities included are, of course, large ones like Toronto, New York, Boston, Chicago, and Las Vegas. The tour is going to be co-headlined with the Finnish symphonic metal band Apocalyptica. So if you're into J-Rock and you've never heard of Der En Grey, it might be a great chance to see a really popular band. In other anime news, another popular J-pop artist, Nana Mizuki, or Mizuki Nana, best known for her works doing the openings of the anime's Magical Lyrical Nanaha, Magical Lyrical Nanaha A's, and Strikers, and all of those, is going to jump over to the voice acting side of things. BTV, AVEX Broadcasting and Communications Television Service for Japanese mobile phones, is releasing a movie comic. It's a motion comic in English. It's a version of Tezuka Osamu's classic Unico manga. You'll learn about more of Tezuka later in this episode, so it might be exciting. And Nana Mizuki is going to play the roles in the movie comic. It's going to add color, spoken dialogue, sound effects, and special effects to the original manga. And finally, the anime community had to say goodbye to another voice actor today. Peter Fernandez has passed away. He's best known for his role as Speed Racer. Yep. Classic Speed Racer, ho ho! But he also played Racer X in the series, Speed Racer's brother, and several other characters in the English-dubbed adaptation of the Mach Go Go Go, or Speed Racer. He also directed the voice cast and even wrote the lyrics to the signature theme song, Go Speed Racer Go. He later played Lupin the Third, Jigen, present Jimmy Carter in the JAL dubbing of Lupin the Third, the Secret of Mamo film. His voice can also be heard in Astro Boy, Gigantor, Marine Boy, Star Blazers, The Bowler Wars, and Superbook. He made a cameo appearance as an announcer in the 2008 live-action Speed Racer film. If you didn't know that, you might want to go back and give it a watch. Unfortunately, it was time for this great voice actor to go, go, go himself. So, the anime community sends you off with many thanks for your contributions, and we mourn his loss. And that's all I have for you today, guys. This has been Chiaki with your anime news break, with a little bit of an exciting press release in there too. And now we're going to get right back on to the review section of the episode, so stay tuned.
And we are back from that tantalizing anime news break.
Wow. I was tantalized.
These adjectives are just getting more and more ridiculous.
I know. You can only come up with so many adjectives to describe the brilliance that is anime news breaking. Break. But anyway, so now we will be moving on to our reviews, starting with Mitsugi. What do you have for us again, Mitsugi?
Well, a very special person on the forum named Nozaku requested that I not specifically me, but requested the anime Crest of the Stars and Banner of the Stars. And because this happens to be one of my favorite animes ever, I thought I would review it. And I've kind of given away whether I think it's going to be good or bad, but you would discover quite quickly.
I told you he'd be all over that Nozaki, by the way.
Direct
line.
The director is Yoshichika Nagaoka, and this same director has done all of the Stars series. There's a lot of stuff in the Stars series. It started in 1999 with Crest of the Stars, a 13-episode series, and it has continued all the way up through 2005 with Banner of the Stars 3. So there is Crest of the Stars, Banner of the Stars, Banner of the Stars 2, Banner of the Stars 3. There are two movies, then there's a prequel, which is an OVA. So it's 10 episodes, and 2 episodes.
Holy shnikes.
If you put them all together, it really only comes out to 40 episodes or so, so it's not really a big deal. But I have seen all of it except the movie and the prequel, because I just simply can't find them. But Crest of the Stars, Banner of the Stars is based on a sci-fi novel series by Hiroyuki Morioka. The basic story is that in the beginning, the world of Martine is a peaceful planet that Jinto lives on, who is one of the main characters, until the day that the Ob Empire arrives. And the Ob Empire is like an alien race. And Jinto's father, the leader of Martine, basically sells out his world in the opportunity to become like a political figure in the Ob Empire. So he basically sells out the whole planet to them. This is like, we're talking a race of people that can conquer a planet, like, easily. Okay? So, basically, what happens is that the Ob take over, Jinto and his father are basically, you know, not, like, there's riots and stuff against them because people are so mad that they gave up the planet. But 7 years later, Jinto has become a count, and he's shipped off to be educated by the Ob to be a noble, and this is when he meets Lafiel. They meet in the airport type of thing, and she is a princess of the Ob Empire. She's one of my favorite characters of all time. I love Lafiel.
You think she's sexy.
She is. However, there are other people in the galaxy, too, besides the Ob, that are powerful, and that's where most of the story comes from. They're called the United Mankind. Ironically enough, it's the United Mankind that are the villains throughout the show, as basically Lafiel and Jinto get thrown into a long war as a result of the clash between the two powers, and you follow the Ob side, so you're basically siding with the Ob. And the war between the Ob Empire and the United Mankind, they rage on so horribly that both sides are basically completely destroyed, and they end up having to call for a ceasefire to rebuild their forces, and this is where Banner of the Stars starts. And Lafiel ends up becoming the commander of her own ship, of which Jinto becomes an officer under her command. And they set out to join a large fleet to defend what is called the Laptic Gate, which is a strategically important location in space, from a force of United Mankind that is 15 times larger than their own. And so that's epic enough, right? And there's also, in Banner of the Stars 2, there is a lot more military figures that are brought about in the show because there's a lot of space combat going on in Banner of the Stars. And so one of the figures is the notorious Bebaus family, they're notorious for what is called spectacular insanity as their lead, because they're like, I guess they're crazy.
I'd like be that. Notorious too if my name was Bobos.
So that's the story. The show is a wonderful space opera with many wonderful characters and concepts. Jinto and Lafiel share what I think is an amazing love story that is very bittersweet. There is definitely a love between the two characters, but because of their martial duty to the Empire and to the military, they really find it hard to, you know, approach this love. And I think the combat in the anime is so cutting edge for its time, and even now I find it to be interesting when I watch the show. The use of strategy and the way that the troops are represented on radar and during battle. I don't know, if you can think about it, imagine like in old movies and stuff where you'll have like a map and they'll like slide the enemy forces along the map with like a big stick. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do.
You know, you have like little pieces and they represent forces. It's kind of like Risk. Well, that's kind of how enemy forces are represented in this anime. But what they do is they have the forces, both good and bad, surrounded in what they call space-time bubbles. And you can't attack each other until you get close enough for the bubbles to merge. And then you merge into one big bubble, and that's basically where you're like locked in combat. So it'd be like incoming ship, and you're going towards them, and you know, you kind of merge and get locked in combat in like a cage. You know, it's kind of like the Ultimate Fighters or whatever. And there's a lot of times where there'll be like a mysterious object floating on the radar. They don't know what it is. There's all kinds of like landmines and stuff. You know, is it a landmine? We got to avoid it. You know, merging with the space-time bubble, merging in 5 seconds, and it comes, and it's like a whole field of mines, and they got to like maneuver around them. It's pretty cool the way that they do that. Every battle and every ship movement is thought out thoroughly. All the characters on the ships realize that there are lives depending on them. There's just a lot of really great high drama and awesome combat throughout the course of the series. The music is done by Katsuhisa Hattori, who did Infinite Revias, which is an anime I did earlier by another review, a requested review. Also, the only other anime I recognized was Argenta Soma, and the Fist of the North Star movie for him. But the show has great music. I don't know, have you seen any of this, Chiaki?
I watched a few episodes with you, and I think it was Banner, not Crest, because they were already on their own little ship thing.
Right.
And the only thing I really remember in it was watching Lafiel and Jinto going, sexual tension!
There is some sexual tension in the show. I don't really think it's not like a big presence.
It's not. I don't mean sexual tension as in like rip off their shirts, but it's like, oh my god, can both of you just get over yourselves and just kiss and be like, oh my god, you're my soulmate.
Well, I'll return to that after I finish the point of the music. The show has fantastic music. It is almost 100% full orchestration the whole time.
Oh, so, gorgeous.
We're not talking like, I mean,
are we talking like Yoko Kanno orchestration?
No, I mean, forgive me, Hattori-san. I mean, you're wonderful. I mean, we're not talking Yoko Kanno type music here. It's still wonderful, though. And if you think about it, the whole space opera, like dramatic battles and that kind of stuff, really lends itself well to well-orchestrated music. It's really great. The what was the comment I was going to make about your thing a minute ago?
I don't know. You just said you were going to comment on the fact that you just want them to kiss, that way they...
Oh, well, basically, I wanted to return to that and say that in The Banner of the Stars 2, the 10-episode series, they really, really... Gosh, I don't want to spoil it, but there is stuff in that section of the show where you truly see the love between Jinto and Lafiel as one of them thinks that the other is going to die or has already died, and you basically see the panic that they're basically unable to help the other.
Right.
And you see the panic that they are put through because of that and the desperate struggle they have to, like, rush to help them. And it's just really touching. The animation is a bit dated. A bit dated at first, but it's hard to really criticize animation at this point, you know, based on being dated. If you think about it, Bebop doesn't look so good now, does it? It really
But it's got that classic look to it.
It does, but, like, so does this anime. They're both made just about at the exact same time. This is an anime that probably came out like right at the exact same point in time as Bebop, so no one ever got to hear about it. even though I will say to you here and now that Crest of the Stars is just as good as Bebop.
I thought you were going to say better for a second there.
I was a little scared.
If you think it is, I really wasn't ready for that hate mail.
I can make that argument easily.
You probably could, but I don't think you should for time's sake.
I won't.
Maybe not.
But as the story progresses and it goes from Banner, Crest of the Stars to Banner 2, Banner 3, the animation gets better. And colors get more crisp and vibrant. It's just it's kind of like the same way that it happened with Initial D. People caught on, they realized there was a fan base, you know, so it got more funding. That's pretty much it. There are flaws in the show. They're not big ones. And one of them is kind of even opinionated. One of the flaws of the show is how faceless the United Mankind are, the enemy. You basically never get to see who they are the entire time. The space combat always takes place within, like, the captain's, like, cockpit area of the spacecrafts, and, you know, where they're giving commands to the other people in the room, and basically they never talk. Like, there's never any, like, we're gonna destroy you, or surrender type of stuff. They're just they're completely faceless, and there's a couple different angles I want to approach this issue. It really adds a layer of suspense to the show by not showing their faces, and that the show really takes a side and sticks with it. I think that, you know, a lot of shows would do this. They would say, all right, so we're going to fully flesh out the good guys, right?
Right.
And then we'll just have a little bit of emphasis on the bad guys.
Yeah.
All right, but I hate that, because basically what you have is great good characters that you love, and then you have bad characters that you've wasted time kind of trying to understand, and it just doesn't quite cut it if you're not going to go through with it all the way. Whereas I think what Crest of the Stars gets criticized for, but I would defend it, is that it doesn't emphasize on the villains at all, and I think it's just them taking a side and sticking with it. You know, no bullshit half-assness. But it's better to have thorough development, you know. But sometimes a show isn't capable of having that amount of development for a character, whether it be for time, money, length. Maybe it's just best that they didn't do it that way. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it's better just to stick with one side and go for it all the way, that rather than to do it half-assed. And I think that's important. A couple of special points I want to make about the show that I think are hilarious. There's one of my favorite new characters from the second season, Banner of the Stars, Commander Spore. And she's really awesome. If you Google Commander Spore right now, you'll get to look at her, and she's pretty sweet. In fact, I'll Google her right now for you guys.
Aw, you're so sweet. You know what I like looking at that picture?
Which picture?
And of Commander Spore.
Mm-hmm.
And I realize I kind of like about the whole series. They really do a good job of building a race and a culture. Like, everyone of the same race looks like they are a card-carrying member of that race, let's say. I mean, like, all of... What? I forgot.
Lafiel?
Well, all the race.
The Ob.
Well, all of the Ob look like they're Ob. And I know that sounds like a duh comment to make, but it's like sometimes you have these aliens and they look nothing alike. And true, there would be some variation in bone structure and things like that, just as in humans. But, you know, they need to have some cohesiveness, especially for the viewer, since, you know, they're a different race. So.
Well, there are some issues that, like, come into play with that throughout the show, because there's a lot of stuff to be said. One of the things I will say is that they really do a good job of fleshing out the cultures of the Ob, because there's a lot of them. And I'll get to a couple of those later. I can't remember if this is true or not. Forgive me if I'm wrong, but I believe that they have genetic ways to alter the babies, and that's why it's such a big deal with Lafiel, because she is a child of true love. And what that means is that when a mother and a father love each other and have a child, and that is apparently pretty rare at this particular time in history.
Mm-hmm.
So, getting back to what I was saying, I love Commander Spore. For a couple reasons, there's one scene where she basically has she has captured a vessel that's just like a resource vessel, and she says, you know, their options are, they surrender, and she gives them two options. The first option is to be destroyed. We can destroy you, or we can send you back to your home planet in normal space. And they're like, well, how long would that take in normal space? And they calculate it out, and it's like, you know, 5 million years. So obviously they're not gonna make it back. And then she's like, well, how about we take out some of the hydroponics and some of the cargo and some of this, and we'll try to lighten the ship up. Now how does that work out? Oh wow. Well, since we've lost some weight, it's lowered the trip by about 10,000 years. See, we did a good thing here. It's that kind of a character. She's just great. And also, one more comment I wanted to make before I wrap this up is, what is Ob-Hell? Ob-Hell is something that is mentioned in the show, but is never really fleshed out to its fullest. I found something online that gives a full description of what Ob-Hell is, and I'm going to read it to you. The opening of the episode that first mentioned Ob-Hell is in Banner of the Stars 2, mentioned an early Ob-Emperor telling an Ob-Man to create something that would be considered horrific, but for the benefit of the Ob people. This creation came to be known as Ob-Hell. While it never explicitly stated what Ob-Hell is, they did mention that it was a fate worse than death and would involve breaking down a person to the point where they would wish for death, no matter how painful. It is neither an afterlife nor a mythos, but rather a living hell. Now, remember, the human brain has certain ways of recognizing pain, agony, depression, and other sorts of negative feelings. The Ob, obviously, are masters of manipulating biological stuff. It can be assumed the Ob have methods to render the receptors in the brain that recognize such negative feelings permanently on, while the Ob keep the victim alive for as long as possible. Being completely depressed in perpetual incomprehensible amounts of pain throbbing throughout your entire body, and generally having every possible negative thing you can dream of being left permanently on at that maximum setting for the rest of your life. Say they maybe leave you alive for 50 to 60 years. Sounds pretty horrible. There was one point in the show where I think it was the queen of the Ob or something threatened to send somebody to Ob Hell, and it was just like an oh my god moment. Because everybody knew it was so horrible.
But sounds horrible.
Anyway, this is a truly wonderful show. It has everything. It has beautiful music. It has beautiful, fully written, drawn-out story that makes sense. It's got love.
A story that makes sense.
It's got action. It just has everything. And, I mean, it's such a classic. I'm going to give it 5 Conquered Planets out of 5. If I could say, oh, maybe a 4.5, because maybe the pacing's a little bit slow in the beginning, or because, I don't know, there's not enough emphasis on the enemy, and you don't really get to see them. Stuff like that is mostly opinionated, and is outweighed by so many good things that the show has to offer. So, truly a 5 out of 5 for me.
Wow.
It's great to have shows that get a good score.
Ones that deserve it.
That might sound stupid to say, but it really is nice to have good shows to review. And I actually have a pretty good review myself. It is a retro review. It was requested by Cool Name.
I'm going to get some milk on this.
His name is so cool.
His name is awesome. But yes, it was requested by Cool Name. And originally, he requested the Phoenix series. It's a manga written by Tezuka Osamu. And I need to give a bit of history for this. There's going to be some history lessons involved with my review on this. Because to fully understand this movie, you need to understand Tezuka. So Tezuka is the god of anime. For anyone who does not know that, anime would not be what it is today without Tezuka Osamu, and I think that there are very few people that would disagree who know the full history of anime. Tezuka Osamu, throughout his life, starting from really when he started his career. He started this manga called The Phoenix. And he took this manga all through his life. And I really hope I'm getting it right, because I'm trying to remember. We actually learned about it in class and this movie, and that's why I was excited to review it while I was in Japan. He started this manga, and it follows the tale, and it circles around these five or six people or so, maybe four or five, but it circles around this small group of people, and it's called the Phoenix because these people keep getting reincarnated as time goes on. And you start from, like, cavemen, like, tribal times, and you go all the way into the far, far, far future. And Tezuka was writing this Phoenix and writing the story of the Phoenix and had this grand idea throughout his whole life. Like, this was Tezuka's, in many ways, his life's work. This movie was actually one of the last movies that Tezuka ever produced. He died in 1989. He died of stomach cancer. And his death was a shock to the country. In fact, the Emperor of Japan died 1 month earlier, and more of Japan mourned over Tezuka, and it was more publicized and more shocking than the Emperor's death. To give you an idea of the emphasis that this man held. You have this man, and, you know, you have his great life's work and things like that, and then, you know, this movie came right at the end of his life. It was one of the last things, you know, he ever produced, and I think this is the mentality that I think I'm going into and that you need to go into when you start this review. So this movie was made in 1980, like I said, 9 years before his death. He was actually battling cancer for a long time, so I'm not 100% sure if he had cancer at this point, but if not, he was diagnosed shortly after. The runtime is about 2 hours. It does feel kind of long, but they cover a lot. And again, you know, you got to remind that it's another space epic, so I guess this is the episode of space epics. But they cover a lot in the show, so even though it's 2 hours and it's kind of long, they do cover a lot. The animation is really, really good for a movie that's so old. I mean, it's old animation. Like, if you compare it to today's standards, it's mediocre at the absolute best. But back then, by yesterday's standards, let's say, it was fantastic. Another thing you'll see in this movie is you'll see a lot of characters that you might notice from other Tezuka works, like Blackjack or Astro Boy or whatever. And this is another little bit of Tezuka history while we're at it. Tezuka, where he grew up in a small town in, like, southern-ish Japan, closer to central Japan. And in this town was this theater called Takurazuka. And the Takurazuka Theater was this theater that had reverse kabuki, essentially. So instead of all the actors and instead of all the performers being men, all the performers were women.
Oh, that's interesting.
And all the men's roles were played by women. In fact, the women who played men's roles were generally even more famous and more desired. But this theater is highly revered, even into today. Girls petition to be in it, they try out. If you get in it, you live on a compound. They have rules, like you can't have boyfriends, you can't have sex. You know, you live, you train, you eat, you sleep together, you perform together. I think the contract is like 3 to 5 years or something like that. And when you're done, you're almost like set for life, because politicians want Takurazuka wives, because it's assumed in Japan that because they live a life of such extreme training all the time, they're diligent, they're detail-oriented, they're pure, because they know that they haven't been running around because they've been in Takurazuka, and they're already loved by many people. One of the things the Takurazuka Theater has is they have troops, and they have, like, the Star Troop and the Moon Troop and the Sun Troop. And it's a troop is a group of five or six women which excel in a certain area. Like, one of them will be the really big, flashy dance show troupe, and one of them will be, you know, the singing troupe or something like that. Each troupe was led, it is kind of led by the prima donna of that troupe. And Tezuka was affected by this model and actually adopted it for his series. And he created these actors, per se, that show up playing different roles in all of his series. So that's why oftentimes, you know, people accuse him of like, oh, he only has like three character designs that he uses. Well, he really does have a number of character designs, but what he does is he takes these stars and gives them cameos. Because in his world of his animation, they're actually actors playing out different roles. So you're going to see a lot of them in the movie. And if you're a Tezuka fan, that's going to be a real treat.
That's really cool.
It's definitely a novel idea, to say the least. So now that I've kind of told you a bit about Tezuka and a bit about the manga and a bit about the history surrounding this movie, I feel like we're better set to begin to talk about the movie. So the first 12 minutes are silent, and they tell the story of the life of this child leading up to his adulthood. And I actually kind of liked the silent aspect because rather than, even though it was still snippets of the child's life, it seemed to flow better without having to try to put in meaningless dialogue. And the other thing is that it added to the solitude that this child was. He was born in a test tube. You see him in a test tube. Then you see him in, like, a baby kind of pen thing. And robots are taking care of him. Like, robot arms are giving him bottles, and they're, like, changing his diaper and whatnot. They're taking care of him. And then, you know, you see him, and he's playing with he's playing in, like, a room, and machines are the things that are entertaining him and teaching him. And for his life, he has no human contact. And again, I think that the silence kind of adds to this solitude of the child. So once he's about, I don't know, I'd say a preteen, he gets a humanoid robot, Olga, which is a weird name if you ask me, but I'm going with it. So he gets Olga, and Olga, his name's Godo, by the way. You haven't found this out yet, but his name's Godo. And he gets Olga, and Olga comes into his life kind of like his caretaker. I don't know if necessarily it's like they decide, oh, he needs to have a real family, so we'll give him a robot still, but one that looks more like a human. But, you know, Olga makes him pancakes, and you can tell as a little kid he's kind of smitten with her, and she can change into multiple things like jets or motorcycles or whatever. And she's there, and she's basically just there to help him. And he's really kind of excited about that. So once he gets to adulthood, he goes to the main administration building, let's put it as, of this city/government building's world. He goes there because he's been chosen to be a space pilot. He was chosen from birth, and he was brought up his whole life. And everything he was taught by these robots was to be a space pilot. So essentially, you're living in a world, this is a very futuristic world in which, you know, babies are no longer born, but they're created, and then they're tested when they're very small, and based upon that determines their life's future.
So that's kind of unfair, isn't it?
So yeah, it's this kind of like very detached world from ours. And so you can really tell that this is the first time he's acting in quote-unquote society. Because he brings his robot with him, and they're like, oh, are you still playing house? Why do you have a robot with you? Put the thing outside. And he's like, this is a member of my family. And they're like, ha, ha, ha. So he gets recruited to be the space pilot, and his teacher's kind of a dick. And he's really, like, harsh. And, you know, he's excelling in his training, but one instance is he's essentially, they release a bunch of small creatures before him, and they're kind of humanoid-like, and the guy's like, shoot them, kill them all. And he's like, no, I don't want to kill them all, they're like humans. And he goes, they're not humans, they're animals from this planet, kill them all. And it's kind of almost an intense scene, because he's like, I don't want to kill these creatures, and then the guy's like, fine, I'll show you how a real space pilot should act. And the guy, like, walks in and, like, you know, these creatures are huddling together and they're scared, and he just blows them away, and you see, like, their bodies on the floor afterwards. So it's like, you know, this really kind of whoa kind of scene. After this training, and after eventually, you know, he's like, oh, you really can be a space pilot, he's gets his mission that he's supposed to go out and investigate this monster that's like a space firebird that's been wreaking havoc and destroying ships and things like that, and he's supposed to capture it. And so he also finds out that the big scientist politician guy, who they call Rock, is actually his twin brother, which was very random and honestly felt kind of unnecessary, but whatever. You know, that's going on, and then, of course, this kid has been raised in a tube for forever. He's now a man. He gets introduced into society.
Tube baby.
What do you think he's going to meet that's going to throw his radar off?
A woman!
Yay! Yeah. So, you know, he meets a real woman, and of course...
Is she hot?
She is hot.
Yes.
And of course, she's Rock's fiance. Yay!
Of course.
So,
no.
I mean, you start understanding, like, this very cutthroat world. Like, he sees a flower and he's shocked by it because there's no plants on this world in the future. You know, there are labor camps where if you disagree with what you've been assigned or do anything that pisses off the government, they send you to these labor camps where you're essentially deemed as a traitor and, you know, forced to be, like, forced labor and forced to be essentially a slave or in... you know, really crazy working conditions. And you really can tell that this is a world on the brink of collapse, environmentally, socially, everything. And you know, there's this little love thing going on between him and... I think it's Raina. Is it Raina? I think it's Raina. Him and Lena, and... you know, that's going on. It doesn't work out. They get caught, of course. She doesn't really want to marry Rock, but she does anyway. And Rock's like, you know, damn, you tried to take my woman. I'm going to put your ass in a labor camp. So he goes to a labor camp, and then you get a cameo from Blackjack, those Blackjack fans out there who might want to watch this movie. Mm-hmm. So he gets put into the labor camp. And, you know, he's working there, and a doctor finds him and says, you know, you're a pilot, you can do this. And the doctor's like, this world's dying. And there's another cameo with the doctor. They're all over the place, but he's like, this world is dying. And the only thing that could possibly save it is the energy from this firebird. He's like, we can harness this energy, and it could fix all of our problems. So he's like, I'll get you out of this labor camp if you pilot my ship to help me get this bird. He's kind of like, well, might as well go with this guy. You know, the world is dying. Olga was still at large, and, you know, she joins up with them as they head out. And they head out into space, and they're on the quest to find this firebird. And some randomness occurs along the way. They eventually do find the firebird, and I'm not going to go too much more into it because, actually, everything I just covered was only the first hour of the movie.
Oh my God.
Another hour after that of stuff. The pacing is fantastic in this movie. Even though it feels long, it only feels long because Tezuka covers so much. But you don't feel rushed either. So the pacing is fantastic in this movie. The movie overall is really, really, really epic. You know, you follow this kid from his birth to his death. Spoiler alert, maybe. But I think it was kind of obvious when Tezuka started at the beginning that he was going to go right up to the end. So you have that, and then you have these love triangles, and you have this commentary on, you know, love between humans and robots, which, again, I would argue that Tezuka invented in the anime genre. You have these themes about conservation. You have these themes about fairness in government and representation and equality and... you know, the ability to advocate for your own sovereignty and things like that. Like, it's a really epic movie with a lot of themes within it. The only criticism that I would give this movie is there are some really random scenes that involve, like, random creatures, and they're very Tezuka creatures, but you sit there, and it's like, you're looking down, why don't I play this flower trumpet for you? And it's, like, 2 minutes of this little creature, like, dancing around the room playing a flower trumpet, and you're like, I don't get it. You're like, and then it's almost like you hit pause on the story, and you're like, intermission! And then you hit play again. Like, that's how almost out of place they feel. And maybe Tezuka was intending them to be, like, an intermission. I don't know, but I didn't really like them myself. I thought they detracted and didn't add anything. So, that's my really only complaint against the movie, though. I mean, the story is a bit random. You have this phoenix in space, but if you understand that he's been working on this phoenix story for a long time, and it's all about rebirth, and it's all about continuing on and pressing forward and rising from your own ashes, it's really mature themes, even though it can sometimes look a bit kiddy. Because I think Tezuka often wrongly gets pigeonholed into being kiddy because he created Astro Boy. And everyone's familiar with Astro Boy, and even Astro Boy has very mature themes in it. But everyone thinks, oh, Astro Boy, Tezuka's like that style, and Tezuka is like a kiddy style. So even though it has those elements, it's a really mature movie. It's a really great movie.
It sounds wonderful.
I really enjoyed myself, and I would really recommend it to just about everyone. Because it has the love aspect, it has the futuristic aspect, it has almost a hint of fantasy, you know, with the phoenix and magic. It has really good characters, it has a lot of different commentaries, and I don't know anyone who I wouldn't say don't watch this movie. Maybe someone who hates Tezuka. And if you hate Tezuka, you need to just revisit your soul. I'm going to give this movie 4.5 rebirths out of 5. And the only reason... Well, maybe not the only, but the main reason being why I wouldn't give it a 5 out of 5 is because it felt a little rushed at the end, and because of those random scenes of, like, these random animals and music scenes and introducing characters, like, of these cutesy animals that I felt really did nothing and weren't even good for comedic relief. So it was kind of like, you're doing well on pacing, you're doing well on story, why waste our time on this? So, I'm going to give it 4.5 rebirths out of 5, but really say it's a very close to a 5. It's a very close 4.5 to a 5, and I recommend it to everyone, because if for no other reason than it's a slice of anime history. So, that's my review, my long-winded review, and I hope you like it, cool name, and I hope that you felt it did justice.
Should I even learn stuff? We learned, like, half of the history of anime and had a review all in one.
By the way, if you want to learn more of the history of anime, I'm doing a history of the horror anime genre at Metrocon.
Well, that's the end of the podcast. Bye-bye.
Oh, come on.
You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here.
Well, there we go, then. end of the podcast. Wonderful reviews. Interesting topic of the evening. I think it was a job well done. I suppose that is the end of our wonderful, wonderful podcast, and our song taking you out tonight is Major Doubt from the anime High School of the Dead by Maon Kurosaki. So,
get it on!
Yeah!
Yeah!
Until next time, you guys, thanks for joining us!